6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street.
Hello and welcome to A Public Affair. It's Tuesday, so that means you've got me. I'm Carousel Baird. Today we have a great show lined up for you. It's always a great show, but this one is, I love when we have more than one guest because that makes it more of a conversation. Today we have Alder Lisa Subek and Alder Mark Clear. They are both aspiring to add to their titles. They are both running to be the assembly representative for the 78th District of Wisconsin, which is pretty much the west side of Madison. Is it a little Middleton, too?
Nope,
no.
It's all Madison.
It's all Madison. That's what I thought. It's redistricting. It used to mean something else. But anyhow, they're both running to be a member of the assembly. There is a Democratic primary. They're both running as Democrats, and they are the only two individuals running in this race. So the big vote is coming up on Tuesday, August 12th. It's less than 2 months away. Yay. I mean, I guess that's a relief for you guys. The deadline is near. You know, you can only run so fast for so long. So thank you both for joining us. And why don't we sort of start off with the idea of tell us your pitch. Why are you running for office? What's important to you? What do you see in your decision to run for this position? Mark, we can start with you.
Sure. Thanks, Carousel. Thanks for doing this show. I'm running because I have two daughters. They're 16 and 21, and I want them to grow up in the same kind of Wisconsin where I grew up, a place where we had proud progressive traditions, things, you know, that we invented, like unemployment compensation, workers' comp, and public employee unions that were all developed here in Wisconsin. And we had the kind of political system where there were disagreements during the day in the Capitol, but they didn't get personal, and people still had find ways to work together. And that's the kind of Wisconsin I want to bring back.
And how you think by running for state office and winning in state office, you can bring that back in this state?
Well, not personally, but every little bit helps. And I'm perhaps naive enough to believe that I'm the kind of person that can work with all sorts of different people. I've done that in 7 years on the city council, worked with people that I don't agree with. And I think even in this environment, there are still opportunities to do that in the state legislature. And the Republicans will not be in control forever.
That's hopeful.
It only seems that way.
Well, thank you, Mark. Lisa, Alder Lisa Subek, tell us why you're running for this seat.
Sure. Well, first off, thanks for having me, and thanks to everybody who's listening. You know, I decided to run for the seat because I have spent my entire career working to make a difference in the lives of women, children, and families. And, you know, I started out teaching preschool, working for the Head Start programs, and then moved into social services where I worked with homeless individuals and families. And during that time, I saw how to make a difference for an individual family, one family at a time, working through a number of broken systems and trying to help families and individuals navigate those broken systems. And I got really frustrated with that and decided that it was time to start working to change those systems. From there, I got involved in advocacy work for just that reason. I wanted to go out there, make a difference, talk to my legislators, talk to the people who make decisions and make those policies, help them see why we needed change, and start to change systems to make Wisconsin a better place for all Wisconsinites, to make Madison a better place for all residents of our city. From there, as I worked to make positive change and had quite a bit of success, particularly around women's health issues and around policies that affect low-income families in our community, I realized I could make an even bigger difference by getting into public service. So I ran for city council, and now that's inspired me to take this next step and run for state assembly. I believe that I'm somebody who has a background that involves making change, that involves being effective, making progressive change on the local level, on the state level, and within our communities. And that's the kind of voice we need in the state legislature. It's who I want representing me and who I hope my neighbors want representing them.
Excellent. So you both sort of started off mentioning children and families. Lisa talking about her advocacy work working with children and families and preschoolers and that sort of whole range. And Mark specifically starting your kickoff with, I have these two daughters and, you know, looking at Wisconsin through their eyes and having that inspire you to run for office. So I think that that's sort of the perfect, that gives me the idea that education and families is one of the top things, not just for the two of you, but perhaps what you're hearing around as you're doing doors and talking with the communities. Lisa, do you want to start on this one and talk to me about education and families and how do you see what's going on at the state and changes that you think can be made or that you think should be made?
Sure. You know, at the core of everything that's good about our state is our public schools and public education. Every child needs the opportunity to succeed. When I'm out talking to folks in our district, whether I'm knocking on their door, whether I'm at an event, one of the first subjects that always comes up is public schools and what are we going to do about the fact that they're not funded adequately. And I believe we need to make some fundamental changes to how we fund our public schools. We need to recognize that at the core of our success is the opportunity for every child to have a good education, whether that's K-12 education, technical schools, our UW system. Folks need to be able to tap into those opportunities. We need to turn around the course that we're on at the state level to start privatizing our schools. We have seen hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars going into voucher schools, first in Milwaukee and Racine and now statewide.
And I believe the one voucher school in Madison is actually in the 78th district, is it not?
It is.
Yeah.
It is indeed. And, you know, we need to turn that around. We need to say, you know what, let's spend our public money on our public schools, ensuring every child has an opportunity for a great education. Every one of those dollars that goes into those unaccountable private voucher schools is a dollar not going into our public school system, not ensuring every child has the opportunity for a really great education. So I think we do need to turn that around. But we also need to look overall at how we fund our public schools. And certainly Tony Evers has proposed his our state superintendent has proposed his fair funding plan. And I think that merits a really close look. We need to look at how is it that we change the system. State aids have been shrinking to our schools for years. We need to put our money where our mouth is and, quite frankly, put our money where our values are. And we know we value a strong public education. We need to start putting our money there.
And do you think that you had said for many years, you know, part of the conversation that sometimes when I talk with teachers, they say this isn't a Scott Walker problem. Scott Walker illuminated and worsened the problem, but we weren't doing so great when we started.
Yes, certainly we have seen the largest cuts to public education that we have seen in generations under Scott Walker, but we were already struggling with a system of shrinking aids to our public schools and really a faulty system. I mean, we're funding schools on property taxes, which are one of the more regressive taxes, and it would make a whole lot of sense to look at a more progressive way to fund our schools overall.
Mark, what do you think about public schools?
Well, I agree with everything Lisa said. And, you know, education is the most important thing that the state does. There's just no question about it. It's more important than things that we spend more money on, unfortunately. And I think if we spent more on education and, as Lisa said, put our money where our values are, we'd be better off on some of the things that we're really lopsided on compared to a state like Minnesota, that we should be a lot more similar in terms of what we spend on education, the kind of educational results that we get, and the number of people we incarcerate, which I think you could make a good strong argument is an education failure in many cases. And so I look forward to working with the entire legislature to look at this. You know, it was Tommy Thompson who promised many years ago to help move schools off the property taxes and create a more fair balance. And the state has completely failed in trying to do that. We have, you know, more responsibility on the property tax, not only for schools, but also for local government than we've ever had before. And so, you know, we need to create a more fair taxation system in the state as well.
So how should schools be funded if not property tax?
Well, it should be partially property tax, but there needs to be a balance between property tax and income tax. I mean, both of those kinds of taxes have inherent unfairness for certain kinds of people who have certain things going on in their financial lives. And so creating a balance between income tax and property taxes is the most fair way, I think, to try to address that and fund all the things we do in the state, not just schools.
Now, when you mention prisons, I mean, that's sort of talking about it's more than just the schools. It's more than showing up to school and what you do in that classroom. It's sort of the big picture infrastructure. Is that sort of, I mean, is that what you're alluding to? That
Well, I was talking specifically about the amount we spend on corrections compared to the amount we spend on education, which, you know, that's an indication, I think, of values that are a little out of whack.
But you can't just take $50,000 out of it, out of the prisons and send it to the schools, or
right.
can you?
Right. Well, you can't because it needs to be an ongoing process. And, you know, it probably takes a generation to try to change the tides of the way those things have gone in our state. But it can be done, and just ignoring it just makes the problem worse.
What do you think about voucher schools? Specifically, I wanted to talk about the fact that the one voucher school in Madison is in the district. It's sort of on the border, and I actually have gone and talked with the people there because it was part of my county board district. But wanted to sort of get your take on voucher schools in Madison. Are you surprised that there's only one school that's doing it? Is that a statement that the community won't tolerate it, or is that just
I think it is. I mean, I think that Madison in particular values public education very highly, and it doesn't surprise me that there would be very little interest in it in Madison. It's disappointing that there's one. I understand there's only 4 or 6 seats, something like that, that are actually voucher supported. So it's, you know,
I think there's 10.
Okay. So it's a small number, and, you know, we can take some solace in that. But still, you know, siphoning money away from public education to private schools is just wrong. And, you know, the reason we have public schools is that we create equity for everyone. And, you know, it's one of the basic reasons that we have government is for education. And so people wanted to go to private schools. That's a fine idea. But because everyone has the opportunity to go to public schools, that's where public dollars should go.
Lisa, what do you think about sort of the private, specifically the private school that's in your district? My fear is that they're a little bit dipping their toes in the water. Let's see what happens. Oh, there wasn't a giant uproar. Take note, other private schools out there. You too can do this, and Madison won't, you know, throw bricks at your wall.
Yeah, certainly I don't expect anybody to go out and throw bricks in the physical sense, but in the metaphorical sense, we really should. We should be concerned about every dollar that's coming from our public schools and being siphoned off to private schools through this voucher system. You know, where it's located in Madison, I think, is not as relevant as the fact that we do have a school receiving voucher funding in Madison. You know, this isn't to speak to the quality of that particular school, but certainly we have seen overall that voucher schools don't perform better than our public schools, and in fact, in many cases, perform worse. We have also seen with the latest round of vouchers that went out, a huge proportion, I don't remember the exact percentage, but it was a majority of those vouchers are going to children who are already in private school, whose families were already in a position to afford and pay for private school, and now we're subsidizing that. And the taxpayers are on the hook for that, and all of our children who are going to public schools, who are trying to get a good public education, are suffering for it.
So then the next question is, besides education, then what other programs are there where you can get more, if you need more government funding for education or for whatever your vision is? Where do you see sort of the change in how government does work?
So, Sammy, I think you know from being on the county board, and certainly we know from being on the city council, everything interacts with everything else. So it's never as simple as saying, let's just take some money from this and put it in this. But let's use that school-to-prison pipeline that we were talking about. While on one hand, you don't overnight relieve the cost of corrections by increasing investment in education, in the long haul, when you invest more in education, you naturally shift money away from corrections because you don't need as much money. One of the many risk factors and one of the strongest risk factors for folks who end up in that prison system are folks who weren't able to attain or didn't attain a good, strong public school foundational education. The same could be said for mental health services. For every dollar that you invest in mental health services, you're reducing the need in our prison system, in corrections. So you have to look at some of those cause and effect interactions. We also simply have to look at where our priorities are. Certainly, you can look at any budget and find some money that somebody wouldn't spend on something and some that somebody else would spend on something. We need to take a good look at that. And more importantly, we also have to look at how our revenues come in. We have to acknowledge the fact that we have a real problem in that more and more of our tax burden is being carried by lower income and middle class families in our state. We need to look at how we tax. We need to look at who gets tax breaks, who gets corporate subsidies, and we need to start dialing those back. We need to make sure that every Wisconsinite pays their fair share. It can't, you know, we can't have the burden carried more and more by middle class families. We need to look fundamentally at how our tax system works, look at where it's broken, and start ensuring that the wealthiest Wisconsinites are paying their fair share, that the wealthiest corporations aren't dodging our taxes and are paying their fair share, so that there's more to go around for everybody.
Mark, what do you think?
Well, I think just to follow up a little bit on that, I think the second biggest thing that's broken in state funding models beyond education is transportation. We have a system that's funded primarily by gas taxes, and it doesn't nearly keep up with the amount we're spending on highways and mass transit and bike facilities. And all those things are really important, and they're important to support the infrastructure of our state. But we need to change the funding model. The gas tax hasn't changed in many years now, and we're making it up simply by borrowing additional money. And that's not sustainable. The amount we're spending on transportation is going more and more, not for actual infrastructure or for buses or anything else. It's going for debt service. And the more that grows, the worse it gets. And eventually, you know, all we'd be spending on is debt service. And so we need to look at that funding model, too. And we need to do it quickly. We're losing ground very rapidly.
When you look at all the things that the state government does, and there's so many pieces to the puzzle and so many pots, do you, and you talk about the importance of mass transit and transportation in general. Is that sort of high on the list of priorities for you?
I think it is. I'm a big proponent of alternate transportation, whether it's mass transit or bike facilities, pedestrian facilities, and I think that's the future. You know, single occupancy cars, I think, are eventually going to be an endangered species. We can't afford it individually. We can't afford it as a society. And I think those things are going to start going away. We're already seeing, you know, numbers of vehicle miles traveled starting to peak, if not fall off. And younger generations are less interested in driving. You know, my own daughter didn't get her driver's license until well after her 16th birthday. It just wasn't that interesting to her. And That's a big difference from when I turned 16.
Yeah, it was a celebration when I turned 16.
Yeah, I mean, I got my driver's license on my 16th birthday, and it represented freedom because there weren't that many other options. And I think now we're lucky enough to have a great Madison Metro system in Madison. We have great transit systems in other parts of the state. And we need to make sure that those are affordable for people and that they're well used, they're well funded, they're clean, they go where people want to go, they're available. And all those things are things that definitely we should fund as a state. And look at the amount of dollars we spend on highways and start to think about, you know, is this the best use of our dollars? It's tremendously expensive. We're about to spend $1 billion to add a lane to I-90 from here to the state line in Beloit. And what are we getting for that $1 billion? You know, 4 minutes off your travel time between here and Beloit, or bringing tourists to the Dells? That doesn't seem like a high priority to me.
Go ahead, Lisa. Sure.
You know, that speaks to one of the biggest mistakes I think that was made under Walker's leadership, or lack of leadership, as some would say, which is turning down the money for the trains. I think that was a devastating mistake. It would have been a cost saver in the long run. It would have been good for our environment, good for the people of the state, and quite frankly, good for businesses that want to grow here and want to be able to have that ability to have that mass transit in place. But I think that it's really important that we recognize that we are creating some of our own problems when we do things like turn down federal money for a high-speed rail. We create a funding gap then in our roads infrastructure.
That's absolutely true. That decision is going to echo for many, many years. That opportunity will not come back. And it's really a shame, very short-sighted, for the very small amount of annual subsidy that that service would have required, far less than any other mode of transportation. You know, it's just sort of a shake your head and pound your head on the table kind of moment.
I'm talking with Mark Clear and Lisa Subek, candidates for Wisconsin Assembly. They are running in District 78, the west side of Madison. The primary election is on April 12th, to remind everyone.
Well, August.
August 12th. April 12th would not be right. There might be an election on April 12th, but we won't worry about that yet. August 12th, and there's going to be a primary for everyone in Wisconsin to vote on the governor's races on that ballot as well.
And the attorney general.
And the attorney general. Mm-hmm. Thank you for reminding me of that. So we touched a little bit on jobs and the idea of this high-speed rail. Lisa sort of mentioned it. You know, not only was it a bad environmental decision, it was an economic decision. And I always think the three of us are local elected officials, and I always think the hardest thing, the most intangible thing on the county board for me is people always say, are you creating more jobs? And I'm like, I don't know how do I make a job show up? Like, it's so tricky. And I sort of, in my mind, think that's what the state does. And then I think, how the heck does the state do that? So I think we started with Mark last time, so we'll start with Lisa this time. Lisa, talk to us about jobs and the economy. And, I mean, if the state doesn't do it, who does? But I'm hoping you're going to say the state does, because the county, this is not our chief point.
You know, I think job creation is something that happens on every level. I don't think it's as simple as the state checks it off the list, or the county checks it off the list, or the city checks it off the list. I think there are things that we all do that contribute to job creation. You know, when I talk about job creation, I like to think about what kind of jobs we create as well. Because first off, it's very easy to say the governor has failed miserably on his promise of more jobs, and we all know that. We know that the Democrats made some proposals that would have helped improve those numbers. Investing in technical college education, investing in training programs, investing in programs that help connect people to jobs, investing in infrastructure, which helps develop those jobs. Certainly making some smart investments in green energy and a green economy that would help to grow the number of jobs by growing those businesses and growing that economy. But we also have to remember that it's not all about a job. So I'll use a Madison example. You know, we talk about investing in hotels. Do we invest in the Edgewater? Do we invest in this Judge Doyle Square project? This is a very local example. Well, when we invest in that, one of the questions we have to ask is, what do we get out of it? And I believe the same is true at the state level. One of the questions that I'm asking right now about the Judge Doyle Square project is, should Madison be investing in a hotel in order to develop jobs that don't even necessarily pay the city living wage? And that's a question that we have to ask ourselves, because is it worth creating a job if it's not a job that somebody can support their family on, if it's not a job that someone can live off of? So I think the state needs to be smart about how we invest any dollars that we are investing in job creation. I also think we can set standards to ensure that every job created is a good job. And certainly that goes to things like raising the minimum wage.
Do you support raising the state's minimum wage?
I absolutely 100% support raising the state's minimum wage. I support the bill that's currently been proposed by Corey Mason to go to $10.10. I would be supportive of an increase to $15 an hour as well, and have been out there on the front lines with workers fighting for that for a number of years now. You know, ensuring benefits like paid sick leave is another critical piece. If folks have a job that is secure and they know that a day off sick or a kid with chicken pox isn't going to cause them to lose their job, or cause them to go a week without pay and not be able to pay their rent, we are all a lot better off in the long run. So we need to focus not only on jobs, but we have to look at the quality of those jobs. We need to ensure that they're jobs that folks can afford to live off, can afford to raise their family on, can afford to be a part of our great state.
Is that legislation you would propose, and do you think it has a chance of being successful at the current state legislature?
Certainly that's legislation I would propose. I think that it would be many years out before we pass it. But, you know, something that we've experienced so many times before is that it often takes years to make soup, so to speak. You know, I look at a bill that we did when I was working at NARAL Pro-Choice Wisconsin around comprehensive sex education. Had to be introduced 10 times or more over 10 legislative sessions before it ever passed. But each time we got a little bit closer, and I am interested in working to get a little bit closer. We can find where we have common ground and build from that. And we can keep getting a little bit closer until we have the state that we all want to live in and that we can be proud of.
Mark, this is a little bit of an area of expertise for you in that you run a small business.
I do.
Talk to us about your vision of jobs at the state level.
Sure. I've also been on the City Economic Development Committee for almost 10 years now. I came on well before I was elected. And so it's something we talk about a lot. But you're right that government, especially on the local level, doesn't really create many jobs. But there are many things that government does that affect job creation. So in addition to completely failing on setting an environment for creating jobs, Wisconsin has also really failed on business creation. And that's something that's really important to me. I've been involved in the startup entrepreneurship community for many years now. And I think that one of the things the state can do is support that kind of environment. That means things like technology transfer from the university, turning that into new businesses, some of which will succeed, some of which will fail. The key is to fail fast and start again and do something else that will succeed. And we've seen a number of successful businesses, some using university technology and some just created here in part because the university helps bring people with great ideas together. And supporting that community through things like making sure that capital is available, making sure we have the right kind of fundraising regulatory environment so that new companies can go out and raise money, get investments, hire people. I mean, that's where jobs really get created, and then succeed or fail in the market. And, you know, we have many great serial entrepreneurs in the Madison area. We have a number of centers of entrepreneurship throughout the state, but Madison is really the core of entrepreneurship for the state. And there's so much opportunity that we're not making good use of here, in part just because we're not a good place to raise money. The state has made some efforts on that. There's a fund that's been created through a joint effort of WARF and SWIB, the State Investment Board. And there's also a new state, investment fund that was created last year, but it's only $25 million. And that's a drop in the bucket compared to what other states have done. Minnesota's is 10 times that size. And that helps create businesses, creates jobs that will move our economy into the 21st century.
And maybe a follow-up. We have some calls waiting, but I want to ask a quick follow-up on what you guys were talking about. So hang on there, callers. Because sometimes, and you know, maybe I'm going to get bonked in the head for asking this question, but sometimes
jobs... We wouldn't bonk you in the
right,
head.
Right. Only the callers when I walk out the front door of work. Sometimes I feel like the talk on... job creation is a little hocus pocus, mumbo jumbo of like, if we had more money, we could give them more capital, is what Mark's saying. And Lisa talking about, well, if we fund the technical colleges. Okay, so how does that make a job come? Help me. I'm a little pedestrian, perhaps, in my understanding of job creation. So, Mark and then Lisa, can you help me understand a little bit? Does this really make a job show up?
I think in part it does, because one of the reasons that a business gets created or stays in a particular location or moves to a particular location is the quality of the workforce. If you can't find the people with the skills you need, then you can't create the business or you can't grow it in a particular location.
So you think there's businesses out there in the United States that would locate to Wisconsin? Not immediately. I know you're not saying they'll show up tomorrow, but that they would if they felt like this was a place to foster jobs?
Absolutely. One of the most important criteria that businesses look at when they're deciding where to locate is the quality of the education system, the quality of the workforce, because if they can't hire people to do the work that needs to be done, or they can't get people the training they need, then they're going to look somewhere else. Now, that said, you know, trying to attract companies to our state is a very, very risky business.
It's the Rebecca Clayfish job.
Yeah. And, you know, God love her for making cold calls into Illinois. I don't think that's particularly effective. And I think we have to be very, very cautious about offering specific kinds of incentives, because the rates of success at trying to lure especially large companies to move to a particular area, it's very challenging. And you do have some successes. We've got, you know, a big distribution center for Amazon in Kenosha. But, you know, those are few and far between. You can invest a lot of money in those kinds of things and get very few successes.
Lisa.
You know, yeah, I do agree that it's hard to attract businesses here through incentives, and definitely a dangerous precedent and dangerous way to go. When I hear things about a good climate for business, that makes me nervous, because oftentimes that means not doing the environmental regulations that we so much value.
Not taxing.
Sometimes that means not taxing fairly. And quite frankly, we've gone down that route and we've seen that it's failing miserably. Often it means not doing things like raising the minimum wage or providing or requiring paid sick leave for your employees. Things that are values that we should be aspiring toward. You know, I think we have to look at certainly some of the factors that Mark mentioned around education, around opportunities, around a highly skilled workforce as part of how we do this. I don't think, though, there's any magic wand that is ever going to come out and just say, boom, you've created the jobs. And I do think that we have to look at what opportunities we're creating. A lot of the jobs that Marcus talked about have been in the tech sector, have been coming out of the university. And I got to tell you, I worked in the homeless shelter system. I worked with working families who couldn't make ends meet, or families who are bouncing from individuals who are bouncing from job to job. And those individuals are not in a position at this point to tap into those jobs. That doesn't mean they don't have the potential to in the future, but that's where those investments in education come in. But we also have to acknowledge that that's not the right course for every person. Not everybody can work a high-tech job. Not everybody wants to. Not everybody will or can develop that particular skill set. So we need to think about the different skill sets. We need to think about those manufacturing jobs that we've lost, and what do we replace them with? I think we have to acknowledge that manufacturing is a dying breed in this nation, not just in this state. And how do we attract what manufacturing we can, but how do we also look to new technologies? How do we look at things? I mentioned the energy efficient technologies earlier. You know, how do we incentivize using solar, doing things that then in turn create jobs? Because when we are helping people to make their homes more energy efficient, the money is there. So instead of giving it to some big corporation, we use it to help people improve the energy output of their homes or their buildings or their commercial facilities. And that in turn creates jobs, because we need folks to come and do that work.
We should get to the callers, but I do want to follow up on that if we have time later.
Okay. We'll put that on hold. Okay. Well, thank you so much to we have two callers waiting. We'll see if they're still there or if they're mad at me for pushing them off. All right, so tell us your name and your question for both Mark Clear and Lisa Zubek.
My name is Thomas Kozlowski. My question regards the Judge Doyle Square and the TIF funding for that, which means that the TIF district, all the money that would be increased because of the increase in property taxes will not go to the schools. In fact, it's estimated as anywhere from $40 million to $100 million plus a time of 20 years, which means that's going to be hundreds of thousands of dollars that will not go into the local school district. So my question for both of them, are you going to vote for that TIF funding or not? And the second question is, when you mention Amazon, which is getting a huge amount of money from both the state and also from Kenosha itself, those jobs are really not very good paying jobs, and they're slave wage jobs. In other words, the people who work at them have to run night and day, and there's been cases on that that have been brought out in the news how terrible they are. So just like Kmart, those jobs don't provide anything, and we, the taxpayer, pay them through because we have to support the food for them through the food stamp program and so forth. So I like your response, their response to these two questions, and thank you for the program.
Thanks for the question. So, Mark, do you want to take the TIF district question first? You're both on the city council, so...
And actually, Thomas and I have had many good conversations about TIF. I don't know how much time you want to spend on this because it is kind of a local issue, not really related to it, but obviously it will affect both of us. So on Judge Doyle Square specifically, I am still keeping an open mind. We don't know exactly what the TIF request will be. We don't know exactly what the project is yet. We're going to find out hopefully sometime in August exactly what the specifics are. And then the math has to work. In terms of the amount of investment that the city will make. And remember that there's a lot of investment in parking as well as in a hotel. And the math has to work in terms of how fast the TIF district will be repaid and what kind of a generator it will be for other development in that area that will help support that area. And most importantly, you know, I really support commercial development in general. And have supported it many times with TIF contributions because of the reasons we talked about at the very beginning of the show, that the property tax burden on single-family homeowners has shifted so much, and it's because our commercial development in Madison has lacked, and at the same time, so much more of the city is funded on property tax. And that's just hugely increased the burden on homeowners, and we need to do commercial development to be able to restore that balance.
Lisa?
Sure. You know, as Mark said, there are a lot of unknowns still in this project, so it's hard to say what the final product will be that we will be voting on. What I have made clear from the start is that I'm not comfortable with subsidizing a luxury hotel with TIF, and I'm certainly not comfortable subsidizing it if we do not have substantial community benefits and have an agreement outlined on what those benefits will be and what will happen if they don't occur. And when I talk about community benefits, I'm referring to things like those living wage jobs, like environmental benefits, something more tangible than simply more room tax revenue. So specifically on that project, that's where I'm at.
Can I sort of ask a follow-up on this, which is how does your work on the city council sort of influence what you think about when you want to run for assembly? Maybe we'll let Mark do this one again and give Lisa a second to catch her breath there. You know,
sure.
You've been on the city council.
That's a great question because it is one of the reasons I'm running is that, you know, over the years, and I know Lisa and I have worked together on some of these issues, I've been very frustrated at the kind of intrusions that the state legislature has made on local government. I mean, we've talked a lot about the funding stuff, but there's also all kinds of preemption that has happened by the legislature on things like, you know, tenant rights is the most obvious one that we've talked about a lot. Madison has a different kind of tenant infrastructure economy than other parts of the state. And so we need different kind of, you know, tenant protections and landlord regulations than other places in the state. And the legislature has preempted almost all of our tenant protection in the city. And it's one of many, many examples of things that that the legislature has preempted us on. One thing, thankfully, they didn't accomplish was on our living wage. And, you know, both Lisa and I testified against legislation that would have preempted the city's living wage. And again, Madison's economy is different than that in Wausau or Rhinelander. And so we need, you know, a different environment for workers than other cities need.
Lisa, what's sort of your take on being a local elected official and then taking that perspective to the state house?
Certainly, I've seen how state decisions impact our local government. I think that definitely is a big motivator to run for office. But, you know, it runs a little bit deeper than that. And I think that TIF example is actually interesting within that context, because to some extent, you see how the state does business versus how we do it locally. And as I said, I have grave concerns about big TIF giveaways that I see really as corporate subsidies. And I see the same thing happening at the state level. I see the answer to job creation being we WEDIC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, gives out big subsidies. Now, I think at the city, we do a much better job of holding the folks we subsidize a little more accountable than they do at the state level. But I don't think we can subsidize our way out of our problems. Certainly, that hasn't been effective, and I don't think it will be. So that's a motivator. I've been really frustrated by all of the state preemption. I think there is a place for the state to set standards, and there's a place for local governments to do that. And when it comes to things like the tenant-landlord regulations, that when I worked in the housing field, I worked really hard to get those laws passed. I came to city council meetings and testified on them. My clients came and shared their stories and their experiences, and that's why we have laws like that. And it's really sad to see the state moving in and preempting those laws. There are certainly places, though, where the state should set regulations. And I want to make sure that we have that healthy balance of, the state being where it belongs and certainly the local government being empowered to make decisions where it should.
Let's take another call. Thanks so much for waiting. Tell us your name and your question for Mark and Lisa.
My name's Mike. I agree that we need to encourage more bicycling, even though we're second best in the country on this. We need to go. We only have 6%. That's a lot less than people that are driving. We do need more to spend more on mass transit. Encourage people to do that. The price of gas is going up. That should help. But we also have been undercutting public education to our children's demise. And the other thing we're doing with all this encouraging highway travel and jet travel, incidentally, the hotel, I disagree that you go into, because jet travel spreads greenhouse gases like no other vehicle throughout the world. And so to get back to we need to be thinking of our children, what their future is going to be like. We should not be encouraging people to fly to tourism and to exotic places. They should stay here and take their vacations, buy local, and vacation local is what I also say. Consumer spending is definitely at the heart of improving our economy, and we have to take some of that state money that's going to go to expanding highways and put it into improving local economies and rewarding people who use less fossil fuel through driving less, flying less, using less natural gas or coal in their heating. And our city should also be looking at our gas pipelines to see if they're leaking methane like they are in a lot of parts of the country.
Mike. Thanks for your comments. I sort of hear this as a question about environmental initiatives. So, Lisa, do you want to sort of take that as a good segue into what do you think about environment? I know we talked about mass transportation, but even the bigger picture of what does this role on the state legislature play in shaping the environment in Wisconsin?
Sure. So, I mean, clearly Wisconsin is one small part of our larger country and an even smaller part of our larger world. And we are facing significant threats due to climate change. And the only way that we will turn that around is if every state, like Wisconsin, if every country starts to do a better job of thinking about how we as human beings impact our environment. And that means setting environmental regulations. That means not putting money before the environment, which I think we too often do. We have to think not only about what kind of world we are going to leave future generations, but are we going to leave them with an inhabitable world? And I say then that sounds grave and it sounds dramatic, but it's true.
It's realistic.
It's the reality that we face. Future generations may not have a world if we don't start to take better care of it. And much of that starts at that's at the very individual level. It's, you know, each of us as individuals makes a contribution to keeping our environment.
Is it an individual thing or is it more a global and you need bigger actors?
You know, the old expression says, think global, act local. I think it's a mix. I think it starts at the individual level and it works its way up. We as individuals have things that we can do to ensure that we are making positive, not negative contributions on the environment. Certainly government has a role in that. Government has the role of setting regulations. Some of the biggest polluters are those very companies that we too often turn around and subsidize. Look at the mining debate on the state level, and I think that's a great illustration of, you know, you have the governor saying, all of this mining is bringing in jobs. Isn't that wonderful? That's job creation. But we have to look at our priorities as a big picture. We have to line them all up and look at it together. And, you know, can we afford to create jobs at the expense of our natural resources, at the expense of our environment? And I think that that is one of the biggest mistakes government can make, is deregulating in the name of job creation. And we really need to take that close look and say, okay, we have a role as state government to set regulations, to protect our land, to protect our water, to make sure that our world is here for future generations. And we need to, in turn, put the same pressure on other states across the country, put the same pressure on the national and even the global structures that exist.
Mark.
So it kind of comes full circle to the reason we talked about this at the very beginning, was, you know, about education and the future. And Wisconsin, again, used to be a leader on these issues. It used to be a leader in terms of environmental protections and all the ways that we supported our environment. And we've lost our way on a lot of that. And we have a very politicized Department of Natural Resources. And we have a politicized environment in terms of making regulations that are based more on who has the dollars than based on science. And I think we can return to that kind of thing. You know, the Republicans talk a lot about valuing the outdoors and Wisconsin's wilderness areas and hunting and fishing and all those sorts of things. But the reality has not matched
just
up.
Just lip service.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, I really think they believe that. I mean, I think they do value these things, but there's a missed connection somewhere between the way they act and the way they talk. And you can see the results of that all over Wisconsin, where there are, you know, areas that have been, we talked about mining, we talked about, you know, clear cutting, things like that, where we have not been good stewards of our state. One last thought on that about the starting locally. You know, it does start with, you know, in your own home, making decisions about what things to recycle and how to get to work every day. You know, whether you're going to use transit or bike or whether you're going to drive. And, you know, those are the kinds of decisions that not only affect your own little environment, but also affect the example that you set for other people in the community. I can remember when I first started on the Economic Development Committee and I would bike to that meeting, it was sort of a joke that I was the weirdo who biked to the meeting. And now, you know, only 8 or 9 years later, it's not unusual, it's not noteworthy that somebody bikes to a city meeting. Lots and lots of people do, both committee members and members of the public. And, you know, it doesn't even get any attention anymore because it's normal. And that's a sort of cultural change that's happening, you know, on a small scale here in Madison, but I think, you know, can start to affect other areas of the state and the country as well.
Inspires me to ride my bike more often. Well, we only have time maybe for another question or two, but I wanted to ask sort of a new idea of, is there a war on women in Wisconsin? There's been talked about a war on women in the United States, and that has been debated of whether the U.S. government is waging war. I want to know if the state of Wisconsin is waging a war. And I think because we did two in a row for Mark, we're going to do two in a row for Lisa. Lisa, can you start with this one?
And certainly this is one of my favorite topics to talk about, not because I have good news, but because it is a topic of great interest to me, both as a woman and as someone who has fought passionately on these issues for quite some time. There is absolutely a war on women, both nationally and in our state. When I look at a state government that has rolled back our comprehensive sex ed law that I worked so hard to pass and so many others worked so hard to pass, a law that guaranteed that every teenager who received sex education in our schools had to have a comprehensive and medically accurate education, goes to preventing unintended pregnancy. When I look at a state where we have rolled back access to birth control, when I look at a state where we have now passed a law that requires women to have an ultrasound, in many instances, an invasive ultrasound, and have that ultrasound narrated to her, whether she wants it or not, I see nothing but a war on women. I mean, what is that if not a war on women? And you add to that the fact that we've rolled back pay equity. I mean, we had a strong pay equity law in Wisconsin, and the governor signed a bill rolling that back. We have made it nearly impossible to get an abortion in Wisconsin. If it were not for the courts having put a stay on a law that requires that doctors have admitting privileges at a hospital within a certain within a certain number of miles from the clinic where they're providing abortion care, a ridiculous law, women would not have access to abortion care at all in our state anymore. It's been a shrinking resource, and it continues to shrink. And sadly, we see Republicans in the state legislature working to shrink it. I remember a day when your party affiliation didn't necessarily indicate whether you were pro-choice or not, where there were pro-choice Republicans. There weren't a lot of them, but there was a day when there were pro-choice Republicans who recognized that making a healthcare decision, that the decision a woman makes, is not a decision that should be made by government. Decisions that a woman makes about her own healthcare when facing unintended pregnancy, when trying to prevent a pregnancy, when trying to have a safe and healthy pregnancy, whatever it is, whatever course a woman is following, we need to recognize that those are decisions that are best made between a woman and her doctor and whatever support people in her life she chooses to include. Those are not decisions that should be made by elected officials, legislatures, people in office.
Lisa, I'm going to hold
sure,
you right there because we're near the end of the show.
I could talk forever on that
topic.
Yeah,
that's okay. I bet you guys can talk forever on all these topics, which is why you're running for office. Mark, is there a war on women?
I think there is, and I think that these issues are just as important to men as they are to women. And just in the same way that education is important, as important to everyone as it is to children and to parents. And, I mean, Lisa talked about the kinds of things that have happened. I think that it sort of stems from this ridiculous puritanical thing that, certain people seem to have, typically, you know, members of another party, but it's sort of a regressive notion in this country, and I think that a lot of countries laugh at the kind of puritanical, we think that sex and reproduction is, I don't know, icky. Maybe that's the problem, and don't want to deal with this and want to think that we should be intrusive about it. And as Lisa said, this kind of government intervention is wrong. It comes from primarily, I think, religious ideals, not from science or anything that is even sociologically effective. And it really doesn't have any place in state or national government, for that matter.
Well, I think we are just about out of time. We only have a minute left. I don't know if you want to make a final 20-second statements. Neither of you are nodding. You're laughing, so I can give you the 20-second statements if you want. Mark, do you want to sort of give us your final pitch of?
Sure. I think, one of the things that differentiates us, I've already used 18 of my 20 seconds, is the level of leadership. I've been elected by my peers on the council into leadership positions for 3 of my 7 years. And if you know anything about the Madison City Council, it's a group of 20 highly individual, unique people. And serving in leadership has been a privilege, and I think something that has taught me a lot about working with lots of different people.
Lisa.
Certainly, thank you. I would say I'm the only candidate in this race who has had experience on the local level and on the state level making progressive change. And the voters in our district are looking for somebody who can be not only progressive, but can be effective, who has that experience and who will go to the Capitol and fight for the progressive values that we hold so near and dear and get things done for our district.
Thank you guys both so much. Fully consider myself friends with both of you, and you both would do a wonderful job. Thank you for running for office. Thank you for taking this on. Good luck on August 12th. I want to say thank you to Rachel for engineering our show today and for Lois for taking the calls. Thanks for listening. Bye, everyone.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio.